Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Foss is a Professor of Medical Oncology and Dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Francine welcomes Maura Harrigan. Maura is a nutritionist for the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic at Yale Cancer Center. Here's Francine Foss.
How can nutrition help to ease the burden for cancer patients?
Well, food is sustenance, food is comfort, and as we know, food is love. So emotionally and physically, food eases the burden. Nutrition plays a vital role across the spectrum of cancer survivorship, beginning with active treatment, recovery, and through the transition to health maintenance and wellness care. Each of these phases has a different nutrition need and challenge.
What role does nutrition play in planning cancer treatment?
Actually, a very important one. It's all about having a good offense entering treatment, as you know. Addressing a person's nutritional needs before treatment starts, will help that person better tolerate this acute phase of their care. The goal is to prevent deficiencies and preserve lean body mass. First, there must be an assessment of the person's current nutritional status. Are they well nourished, or are they entering treatment already undernourished? Their energy and nutrient requirements need to be determined. Now the question is, can the person meet these needs through eating their usual foods? There are many common symptoms such as fatigue, anorexia, and pain that may interfere with eating. Then there are nutritional problems related to the treatment itself that must be anticipated. Surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy can cause side effects such as nausea, vomiting, changes in taste or smell, and bowel habits. Again, these symptoms may interfere with a person's ability to eat. So temporary adjustments to the choice and preparation of foods, small frequent feedings, and adding supplemental nutrient-dense drinks may be helpful. But sometimes even that may not be enough, and there may be a need for temporary use of tube feedings to prevent weight loss and ensure adequate nutrient intake.
So when a patient then is diagnosed with cancer and they start thinking about all their treatment and maybe have anxiety about all of that, they're oftentimes not focusing on their nutrition. Should all patients see a nutritionist at the very beginning when they get a diagnosis of cancer?
That would be ideal. To have a registered dietitian come in, speak with the patient and their family members, and also consult with the oncologist to determine the best proactive actions to take before entering treatment.
And oftentimes patients have symptoms that you mentioned, like fatigue, anorexia, etc. Many of those symptoms are related to cancer itself. So how does a patient know whether their diet is playing a role in that? Again, is this something that is going to require a careful nutritional assessment?
Yes. What we do as dietitians is take a careful diet history from the patient, and we could ferret out the issues for the patient and discuss it with their family.
So even patients who think they're on a so-called good diet may potentially have issues with their diet and their intake?
Yes, because how you define a good diet varies with each person.
What about the issues with respect to the specific kinds of cancer that a patient has, say breast versus colon, for instance? Are there different dietary recommendations? I know we've heard things, you know, in the lay press about the role of potentially of fats in some of these cancers, and soy as well, and with respect to treatment. So are there specific diets that you recommend for specific kinds of cancer?
Well, I know that research is trying to determine how best to target nutrition therapies to specific cancers. And some examples are a low-fat diet, limiting trans fat and saturated fat is thought to be protective in breast and prostate cancer. Also, a diet high in fruits and vegetables is considered protective for lung, oral, esophageal, stomach, and colon cancers. But what I'd like to add here is that eating well in our culture is very difficult to do, even without the challenge of a cancer diagnosis. And what is convenient and accessible is high fat, high salt, high sugar, high calorie foods. So assessing a person's customary diet prior to diagnosis is helpful in determining the diet changes to target, and also to assess the person's readiness and ability to change. So I guess what I'm trying to say is where research is going is ideal, but you have to really look at where the person is starting from.
So many of us then really don't have enough fruits and vegetables in our diet as it is.
Oh, that's so true. The FDA 5-a-day program, which all asks people to do is eat 2 servings of fruit a day and 3 servings of vegetables to be the cornerstone of our diet, only 25% of us actually make that goal in a day. And the number one vegetable is potato, which is diced, fried, and salted, so it becomes French fries.
I would have heard ketchup, at least in school systems, ketchup appears to be a vegetable.
I have to say one of my daughters counted that as a vegetable growing up.
One interesting thing after just having come back from the Far East and seeing how folks there eat is it's really, really clear that they do eat more natural foods and more vegetables. And certainly in those parts of the world, the risk of cancer is a lot less than in the United States.
Yes, and that's really the diet that we are promoting is a plant-based diet where the majority of your plate, if you look at it, should be filled with plant foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains. And then you're actually using meat as a condiment. So if you get that visual, and so I try to get people to visualize what a healthy meal looks like, it's predominantly filled with fruits and vegetables and grains, and meat is just a condiment, not the centerpiece of a meal. And so that more mimics the diet that you were seeing in the other cultures.
You talked a lot about trans fat, and certainly this is a buzzword nowadays. A lot of our products are now labeled no trans fat. Can you talk about really the role of trans fat and saturated fat? Is this mostly coming from meat, or is this in other foods that we're eating as well?
It does mostly come from, the saturated fat does come mostly from animal sources. So that would be red meat, processed meats, and also full fat dairy products. Now the trans fats I find are more in processed foods where they do partially hydrogenated oils as an additive. So something like a Pop-Tart would be a food item that would have a trans fat in it.
What about the fats that are in nuts? A lot of people say, well, I know nuts are healthy, but they have a lot of calories and a lot of fat.
Nuts can be a hard sell for people just for that reason. Fat, nuts do contain a lot of fat, which happens to be concentrated in calories. But it's a type of fat called a monounsaturated fat, which is actually quite heart healthy. And I find nuts to be a very useful food for cancer survivors throughout their day to snack on, because it's a nutrient dense, meaning it packs in a lot of calories and nutrients in a very small package. So someone who's having a hard time keeping up their food intake, nuts is a very useful food.
You talked about the role of supplements, these nutritional drinks that we give to patients. Can you talk about those, the ones that are medically prescribed, and then some of the other ones that are available in the drugstore?
Well, the ones that are medically prescribed are ideal in terms of their composition of carbohydrate, protein, and the types of fat in it. Preparations that are found over the counter in the store, particularly high protein powders, can be detrimental to people and misused. Though there is one product that I find that you can get in the grocery store that works beautifully, which is an old standby, which we've all probably grown up with, which is Carnation Instant Breakfast. mixed with organic skim milk is a wonderful supplement, and it's inexpensive.
And you tell a lot of patients that, and they don't actually believe you, so I'm glad that we're hearing it from a nutritionist. What about the whole issue of control over your diet? So once you have a diagnosis of cancer, you already have lost a lot of control in your life. How important is it for people to start, you know, really controlling their nutrition at this point in their care?
It's very important because the person can feel empowered, and it gives them an active role in their care. And it's also a wonderful way for family and friends to be supportive and help by assisting with food shopping and preparing meals. So food can be a wonderful focal point for healing and nurturing in this process.
In terms of family and support folks knowing what the right foods are there specific guidelines, or are there any handouts that you recommend?
That's a good question, because there's a lot of nutrition misinformation out there. So where you get your nutrition information from is very important. There are some wonderful resources that are out there available to patients and families. A few websites that are actually quite terrific. And one is the American Institute for Cancer Research, that's AICR.org, has wonderful nutrition information, and you can actually sign up for an email recipe service. So they email you nutritious recipes every week, and I look forward to that email every week.
That sounds great. Actually, I know that organization because I used to review grants for them, and they really are studying specifically the effects of natural substances in foods as anti-cancers, with anti-cancer properties, as well as the benefit of things like omega-3 and omega-6, which were studied now for a number of years and shown to have specific benefits for a lot of diseases. So I think that's an excellent website. Talking about omega-3 and omega-6, can you mention something about fish oil? This is something that we've all heard about, and it seems to be good for a lot of different things. Is it good for cancer?
Yes, that happens to be one of the supplements that's actually really panning out to have a benefit. Omega-3 has been processed out of our food supply, so there are real deficiencies of omega-3, and it's the balance of omega-3 with omega-6 that seems to be out of whack. So supplementing with omega-3, I feel, is a very good idea, and I usually recommend 1,000 milligrams a day. And there are food sources of omega-3, which are salmon, and also eggs are fortified with omega-3. Certain eggs are. And the way they do that is they feed flaxseed to the chickens, which
wow.
I find
wow.
interesting. You can also add flaxseed to your food, grind it up, and mix it into soups, stews, or sprinkle it on your cereal, and also taking a fish oil supplement.
Is there any difference with respect to the omega-3, omega-6 balance in the fish supplements that are out there? I know that there are a lot of different ones out there, and I know people have said that some are better than others.
That's, you'd have to read labels, and that's something I do recommend for people. You do have to look at the brand and put your glasses on and read the fine print and look for the amount of omega-3 that's in the product.
Of course, it's also useful if people eat the fish.
Well, I'll make this point over and over again. Find it in food. It's much better to find the nutrients in the whole food source than in the supplement. Though we're always looking for a magic bullet, just the research is not panning out in identifying a particular supplement that will prevent cancer or just be the cure we're looking for. The real power is in the power of whole foods. And the nutrients in the food are packaged by nature to actually act in synergy and provide a potency that's not found in any supplement.
Thank you for that information, and I think we should all heed that. We're going to come back after a short break for a Medical Minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about nutrition and cancer with Mara Harrigan.
Over 170,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer this year, and more than 85% of these diagnoses are related to smoking. The important thing to understand is that quitting, even after decades of use, can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Now, everyday patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care, and new treatment options are giving lung cancer survivors new hope. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer, and patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by Mara Harrigan to discuss issues of nutrition and cancer. So, Mara, can you start out by telling us whether there are differences in nutritional recommendations for cancer patients and survivors?
The short answer is yes. We've already talked about the nutrition needs in the active treatment phase. But since I define survivorship from the moment of diagnosis, I would rephrase this question to ask, what are the nutritional concerns of persons transitioning out of active care and into health maintenance and wellness? And these are issues that I find working in the survivorship clinic. A predominant concern of people in this phase is fear of recurrence of cancer. And many people fear that eating a wrong food would actually cause the cancer to recur. And a person may also feel guilty that having eaten a wrong food actually brought on the cancer. These are very powerful emotions that people bring to the survivorship clinic and discuss. I try to allay their concerns by explaining that there's no one food that will trigger a recurrence or protect you from recurrence. However, following an overall healthy diet may help prevent recurrence and certainly help one feel more energized, improve mood, and all of that's through good blood glucose control.
What is the ideal diet?
The ideal diet consists of eating predominantly what we call a plant-based diet. That's one rich in vegetables, fruits, and whole grains, and also limiting the consumption of processed and red meats. Now, just adopting these two steps creates a high-fiber diet that is naturally low in total fat, trans fat, and saturated fat. So this is also ideal for managing weight and also the late effects of treatment, which include a higher risk for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and osteoporosis. I have a few more things to add on to that. I do recommend limiting sugar intake, including what I call the stealth sugars. These are the corn syrup solids and high fructose corn syrups that are often added unnecessarily to foods. And also another important aspect not to overlook is to evaluate a person's consumption of alcohol. The benefits of alcohol are really related to cardiovascular disease protection and are not specific to any cancers. So alcohol consumption in cancer survivors should be looked at. And many people do self-medicate in terms of their anxiety and depression with alcohol. So it's worth evaluating and asking them about their alcohol intake.
So alcohol can actually have a deleterious effect if you're a cancer survivor?
Yes. And one way outside of just the cancer process itself is that it is an extra source of calories, and people can put on weight through excess alcohol calories, and that the excess body fat is metabolically active. It's not an inert substance. So we're finding that the excess body fat is hormonally active, and that's where the concern about weight gain comes in with cancer survivors, that our goal is, one, to prevent further weight gain and also to promote weight loss.
Can you give us some helpful hints on how to actually implement this, and how would you actually go about implementing these recommendations in your diet?
Well, that's a challenge, as I said, to eat this way in our culture. And that's the real hard work at the survivorship clinic, is turning this into real nitty-gritty how to do. And each person that comes in walks out with a different plan because we try to tailor it to the individual. But I tell people we have to start with a good food shop. So I give them a very extensive shopping list, how to go through the supermarket so that they bring healthy foods into their home environment. And that's the first big step. Surround yourself with healthy foods and also carry these foods with you outside your home into your work environment and into your day so that you're armed and ready to eat well.
Should people be eating more than 3 meals a day?
Yes, ideally 6 small feedings a day seems to help people on many levels. One, it helps stabilize blood sugar levels. So that helps across the board with managing hunger and also stabilizing mood. And also with someone who's having difficulty keeping up their calorie intake or their nutrient intake, eating smaller, more frequent meals is an easier way to reach their goals.
What about specific foods? Like, we've heard a lot about the benefits of, say, green tea. Is that something that we should be doing?
Yes, I consider green tea, it's actually categorized as a supplement, but green tea is a wonderful food, and I recommend that to patients. And often a warm beverage, like green tea, in the evening before bedtime can actually be quite soothing to the digestive system and help promote a restful sleep.
Great. What about other supplements? Could you make some recommendations about the use of these supplements? And also, could you talk about how, when you're actively undergoing cancer treatment, sometimes the supplements can be deleterious?
Supplements are controversial. But can you imagine up to 70% of cancer survivors actually use supplements? But they have to be used with caution and concern. And I always encourage survivors to discuss their use of supplements with their physician first, because there are certain supplements that can interfere with treatment. For example, folic acid supplements may interfere with methotrexate, a chemo drug that works by interfering with folic acid metabolism. Also, antioxidant vitamins such as vitamin C and E could interfere with the cellular oxidative damage to cancer cells that is intended by radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And another supplement, which is soy isoflavones. This is supplemental soy in a pill form. This is not recommended for women with estrogen-receptive positive breast cancer, because the supplemental soy does mimic the action of estrogen in the body. Now, that is different. Soy supplements is considered to be different from soy in whole foods. And in fact, with soy in whole foods is considered to be a protective factor in breast cancer. So you can understand why there's so much confusion out there.
So should all cancer patients be talking about these supplements with their physicians?
Absolutely. Because while we know vitamins and minerals are important, more is not necessarily better. And people often take multiple formulas, many different bottles of supplements, and not realizing that there may be nutrients that are repeated in each of those bottles. So they actually multiply their dosages. And there is actually what's called an upper tolerated limit. There is a ceiling on these nutrients that we need to honor. And particular, for example, vitamin A is often a nutrient I see repeated in multiple formulations. And I'll ask people to bring in their bottles. They may come with a shopping bag of 8 to 10 bottles of supplements. And I take them out, look at the labels, and I start with vitamin A, and I start adding up all the dosages of vitamin A and find out that they are well above what we call the upper tolerated limit of vitamin A, which is 3,000 micrograms a day. And other vitamins would be vitamin C. There's a ceiling on that, 2,000 milligrams a day. And vitamin E, which is 1,000 milligrams a day. So I'm looking for overdosing, which can do harm.
Well, rather than coming in with a shopping bag of pill bottles, can we trust the one a day or the Centrum, the kind of all-inclusive multivitamin, multi-mineral supplement? Is that adequate for most people?
Yes, and that's what I recommend. I recommend just your good old solid multivitamin as a way that would fill in the gaps of any possible nutrient deficiency.
So Mara, there are a lot of people out there also who are taking other things like herbal supplements or naturopathic type treatments. Oftentimes it's difficult for them to talk to the physician about this. So can you talk about your role in advising patients about those kinds of supplements?
That is a challenge even for me, because there are times when people come in with supplements that, frankly, I never heard of. So there's a wonderful web-based referral. It's called naturaldatabase.com, which is the complete listing of all herbal and botanical supplements that, frankly, I have to go to and look up to evaluate these products.
And we've had the same experience, and it's been very helpful actually going to that website, trying to figure out what is in some of these herbal remedies. Do you recommend that patients use these, or are you keeping kind of a neutral stance on it?
I try to stay neutral. I do promote, and I try to steer people really back towards a healthful, whole food approach. So when people are telling me that they're going the supplement route, I really take a detailed diet history to assess, well, what are the real foods that you're eating, and look for gaps in that and try to round out their normal eating of whole foods as a way to kind of counter the supplements.
So we keep coming back to the same message here, which is you are what you eat.
Our grandmothers told us that, and it still holds true.
In addition to healthy eating, what other lifestyle factors are thought to be helpful in terms of cancer prevention?
Well, the obvious one about smoking, that's been very clear, and avoidance of excessive sun exposure. Again, I do want to mention the importance of achieving a healthy weight, which we define ideally as a body mass index of 25. But even a weight loss of just 10% from your starting weight can actually confer tremendous benefits of health. And at the very least, if you can't achieve weight loss, at least preventing further weight gain. Kind of dovetailing with that is the value of exercise. And again, we address that in the survivorship clinic. The ideal recommendation is 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. But again, you need to assess where the person's starting from. For some people, that just may be very daunting. So we start small and look at just working activity into their day, parking farther away, taking a flight of stairs instead of the elevator. All those things all are beneficial to managing your weight and just your overall sense of well-being. And what's interesting is that regardless of your activity level prior to your diagnosis, any increase in your movement or activity after diagnosis has been shown to have very profound effects on your health and on cancer prevention.
Can we just talk for the last minute about stress? Everybody obviously is concerned about the role of stress in both cancer and in healing. Can you make some recommendations?
Yes, I would. And again, in the survivorship clinic, our social worker, Lena Chase, offers many, many different methods to manage stress. One is just deep breathing exercises, taking 10 deep breaths. If you take the time and do that and feel the difference before you started and after, it's just remarkable in terms of the calming effect that it has. Also, we strongly recommend yoga as a wonderful stress management, and also helps with flexibility. And Tai Chi, another wonderful exercise. So that mind-body connection is very powerful and very much a part of our holistic approach to managing cancer.
Well, Mara, this has really been a terrific discussion, and certainly a lot of us have gotten some helpful hints that we can implement immediately in our lifestyles. I'd like to thank you for joining me on Yale Cancer Center Answers. Until next week, this is Dr. Francine Foss from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.